In closing,
welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving in Charlotte, North Carolina.
And I'm Ken Rudin in Washington, D.C. And Ron, I had to go to sleep a little early on Wednesday night. Did Bill Clinton ever finally nominate Michael Dukakis?
Actually, he was introducing Michael Dukakis in 1988. And then after a very brief pause, he nominated Barack Obama for a second term last night.
A very brief pause of 12 years. You know what's interesting?
22 years.
22 years. Wow, yikes.
I was told there would be no math.
You know something? I mean, we goofed on Bill Clinton at the 88 convention in Atlanta, and I was standing right in front of him as it was going on and on, thinking, how could this possibly be going on? And that was only like about 28 or 29 or 30 minutes.
It was a little over 30 minutes, and he was allotted 15.
And the Wednesday night speech in Charlotte was 49, 50 minutes, and yet it was just... Look, of course, Bill Clinton in 1988 was not known the way he is now, but it was just, I mean, I can't think of a better, more effective argument for another 4 years than you heard from the former president.
That's right. Back in 1988, Bill Clinton was merely the failed governor of a small state. But in the words of Ross Perot, of course. Bill Clinton, though, last night, I think it was one of those cases of I shall now consume as much time as I may consume. He could have gone on as long as he wanted to go on, as long as he was getting that many hits. Not just in the sense of the audience roaring. The audience roars when people announce the time at this convention. But he was really hitting the ball, and he was defending the most important vulnerabilities of the Obama administration in a factual manner and with a great deal of passion and persuasiveness that's been largely missing in the defenses we've heard from the Obama administration.
You know, I think President Obama learned a very important lesson when it comes to what to do with Bill Clinton. If you ignore him, if you marginalize him, then he pouts, he goes off and does his own thing, he becomes an irritant. But if you tell him how important he is, tell him how valuable he would be to my winning another 4 years, there is no better advocate than Bill Clinton. And it wasn't the angry, ugly stuff that in my view, you heard from Ted Strickland. Bill Clinton had a smile on his face throughout the whole speech. A lot of time was backhanded praise of the Republicans, certainly of George W. Bush, which I found interesting, but really attacking the current day GOP. And again, very, very effectively.
And there is some truth, too, to the contrast that he was drawing between the Republicans he dealt with. And hey, look, I mean, Newt Gingrich in 1995, Bob Dole, who was in the process of running against Bill Clinton for president in 1996, were the leaders of the House and Senate at that time. The Republicans had just seized control of both chambers. They were on the march. Bill Clinton was able somehow to compromise with them in 1996 and secure his own reelection and the reelection of the Republican majorities in the House and Senate with a series of compromise bills on welfare reform, on health insurance portability, on trade. And they actually looked like they were getting some things done. That kind of cooperation has been utterly lacking in the Obama administration. And the great question the voters have to sort out is, who didn't show up for the compromise meeting?
One of the themes of the convention, at least one of the themes that the Republicans tried to make as part of this convention, is, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And certainly the relationship between Bill Clinton and Barack Obama is far better off than they were 4 years ago. When you listen to him Wednesday night on the stage in Charlotte, it just seems like that they've been best buds forever.
I want to nominate a man who's cool on the outside. But who burns for America on the inside.
There was no trace of the 2008 animosity or some of the other bad moments that there have been in this relationship between Obama and the Clintons. And there was a sense of lawyerly analysis of all the differences between the Republicans, all the attacks the Republicans have made, I should say, on Barack Obama, and systematic point-for-point rebuttal in highly factual terms, which are standing up pretty well to the fact-checking that's being done on them overnight and on the day after. So it was a presentation by a lawyer who truly seemed to believe in his client and several times stopped to say, and this I truly do believe, this is in my heart. You could almost see him making a closing argument, a summation, in front of a jury.
What surprised me most, I think, is that in advance, I would have thought that there'd be more enthusiasm at the Republican convention than at the Democratic. For one reason, one, because the Republicans are still angry over 2008, what's happened since 2008. You saw a lot of enthusiasm on the Republican side in 2010. Democrats had their heads between their knees, basically, almost in defeatist fashion. And yet, I mean, Ron, you can speak about it because you're there, but it just seems from watching on television, or should I say watching on NPR, even for a president who's, you know, overseeing an 8.3 unemployment and not great economic outlook, the enthusiasm in Charlotte seems to be tenfold more exciting than we saw in Tampa.
I have not seen a convention since 1984 and the renomination of Ronald Reagan by the Republicans that was more united in support of their president. They have differences with him. You will hear people talking about Guantanamo still being open. You will hear people talking about his failure to solve the immigration problem. And there are many other issues as well. But the level of unification and support and passion for another 4 years for Barack Obama is far higher than I would have predicted even a few months ago. I think a lot of that has to do perhaps with the attitude people have seen from the Republicans. I think it also has to do with the fact that the kind of people who are here as delegates are the truest true believers in Barack Obama and in the causes of the Democratic Party. But they are pumped up.
And it seemed like the way they designed the convention schedule at least looked much more favorable to the Democrats than the Republicans. I'm thinking of the night in Tampa where you had this, what I thought was a very, very effective, good speech by Ann Romney, and then it was immediately followed by a different tone completely by Chris Christie, the keynote speaker. Whereas on the Democratic side, I noticed that on the first night, there was a lot of speeches. Some of them were effective, some of them weren't. I thought Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, gave a very strong speech. Of course, there's some questions about fact-checking as well, but it was a good speech. And it culminated in Michelle Obama's speech, which I thought was a fantastic speech, and maybe we could hear a little of it right now.
Barack Obama is still the same man I fell in love with all those years ago. Yeah. He's the same man who started his career by turning down high-paying jobs and instead working in struggling neighborhoods.
The First Lady did not mention Mitt Romney's name in the entire speech, and yet we know the whole speech was not only about her husband, but it was also about Mitt Romney's failures.
Oh, she shivved him. Time after time, she came back to things like, not only about getting ahead yourself.
Ron, she what him? What did she do?
She shivved him. When she talked about people who cared about what they did and not just how much money they made or how far they got ahead or those kinds of definitions of success, I don't think anyone was having any trouble connecting the dots.
As far as the other speakers, there were pluses and minuses. I was very impressed with Deval Patrick. Far less so with Ted Strickland when he started talking about Romney lacking economic patriotism. I thought Strickland went too far. But you know something?
Strickland also referred to lying.
Lying,
on the part,
right, exactly.
Which is a word that both journalists and politicians generally try to shy away from. Maybe we shouldn't, and there's a lot of argument about that. But it is a word that tends to be a fighting word, and it is one that is usually not used by people who have been governors of large states.
I feel that way, too. And again, just the sense that if we heard it on the Republican side, there would have been an outcry. And there has been an outcry of the rhetoric against President Obama. And I just think that it's just not much better if the other side does it as well. But I'll tell you one thing, though. I was not as bowled over with Julian Castro's keynote speech as most people were. I mean, I thought it was good speech, but given how maybe I'm also comparing it to that, I thought that Patrick was so good, Michelle Obama was incredible, Bill Clinton was vintage Bill Clinton. Maybe the problem was Castro decided to pick a convention when they had these other great speakers there, but it didn't knock me over.
It's a fast league you're describing. You're talking about the people who are essentially the heavy artillery of the Democratic Party at a moment when their rhetoric is enormously important to them. They're dealing with a pretty tough set of facts, and they need to make their case as strongly as possible. I would say Julian Castro's comparison point was Marco Rubio introducing Mitt Romney last Thursday in Tampa. That was the featured spot for a Hispanic with a bright future in the Republican Party. Of course, he's already a senator from Florida. People talk about him going on the national ticket. Julian Castro is the mayor of San Antonio. He's only 37 years old. He probably has a pretty bright future, too. The Democrats are talking about running him for governor of Texas someday. And who knows, maybe he'll be on a national ticket, too. But he's not nearly as far along as some of these other people in terms of his career. And I would say the Democrats were justified in saying, all right, you've got a Marco Rubio over there on your side. We'll see your Marco Rubio and raise you, Julian and Joaquin Castro. They are twin brothers.
You know, we talk about these new rising stars, and while we're doing this podcast on Thursday morning, this evening, one of the people who once was thought to have a huge role at the convention, but seems to be somewhat diminished, is not a rising star in the party, although he may be a possible candidate in 2016. Of course, I'm talking about the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden.
Joe Biden has been here. He was here last night with his wife, Jill, Dr. Jill Biden, as they're always calling her. And she is a person with a PhD. But Joe was given, you know, a nice shout out by former President Clinton. People are paying a lot of obeisance to him in some ways. But he's not getting the primetime speaking slot that you know he craved and has throughout his entire career. So there is a little bit of a sense of eclipse there. It's possible that that was part of the overall bargain by which the Obamas were able to pull the Clintons on board fully. And there is this implicit competition between Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden to be the more or less official Democratic frontrunner for 2016, whether Barack Obama is given a second term or not.
Well, I mean, perhaps part of it was the fact that the convention was truncated by a day that the Democrats decided early that it would be a 3-day affair, not a 4-day affair. But at the same time, you think of the role on Wednesday night, somebody who basically bashed the opposition and set up the arrival of the president, and that usually would have been Joe Biden's role. But the thought of Joe Biden doing it and not Bill Clinton, it's just at this point, it's just hard to even consider.
The featured woman on the program last night was Senate candidate from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren.
The Republican vision is clear. I got mine. The rest of you are on your own. Republicans say they don't believe in government. Sure they do. They believe in government to help themselves and their powerful friends.
What was striking to me about Elizabeth Warren is that it was a very effective, tough speech about Wall Street, which was exactly not the kind of a note that Bill Clinton tried to set. But I've always had a sense that the progressive left wing of the Democratic Party looks at Elizabeth Warren and wishes that President Obama had the same kind of rhetoric that she does. But whether her rhetoric is what the Democratic Party wants to run on nationwide is another story.
Unmentioned in the speeches last night by Elizabeth Warren and by Bill Clinton was the rather uncomfortable fact that the most important regulation on Wall Street, the Glass-Steagall Act, passed back in the 1930s, was repealed while Bill Clinton was president. He signed that. And, of course, it later came back to bite the entire banking system in the latter part of the last decade, in 2008, because banks had been allowed to do a lot of things that got them overexposed to certain kinds of classes of assets. So one of those ways in which the Democratic Party has stuck with its own contradictions about the financial services industry.
One other uncomfortable moment for the Democrats at the convention was over the altering of the platform language. The Democratic platform in 2012 omitted any reference to the fact that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, unlike what we saw in the 2008 language. And there was also no mention of the word God. And, of course, Republicans immediately noticed, and pro-Israel groups also noticed it, and the potential for embarrassment for the Democrats was pretty large. So they changed the language to include a mention of Jerusalem, mentioned the word God, and there was some disruption in the convention because not everybody liked the thought of putting in that Jerusalem language.
They went back to the 2008 language. That was probably not going to have been controversial had they left it in. They had provoked the attention that they got by taking it out, and they basically retreated to the position that the Democrats have usually had, the position that both of the major parties have usually had, which is that Jerusalem should be recognized as the capital of Israel. And then, of course, whoever gets elected goes back to the same position that we have had for decades, which is that the final status of Jerusalem should be negotiated by all the parties. parties to the Middle East. This is the kind of issue that comes up in platforms that is then handled in an entirely different fashion by actual presidents.
Right, but I mean, it does cause discomfort at a convention. That brief controversy over the language was a little stain on the unity that we've seen coming so far. You know, we also mentioned we're talking about Joe Biden and what his plans may or may not be for 2016, but of course, he's in the mix for the post-Obama Democratic Party. Of course, if he does run in 2016, he'll be 74 years old by the time of his inauguration. He has not ruled out a candidacy for 2016, and while Hillary Clinton has said that she doesn't entertain any thought of running again, there are not a lot of people who are not convinced that's the answer either. But we also saw some other potential 2016 candidates on the Democratic stage this week.
That's right. We saw Martin O'Malley, who is the very ambitious governor of Maryland. He is serving in his second term, won easily in 2010 in a rematch with a man he had beaten in 2006. Very few Democrats had as easy a time in 2010 as Martin O'Malley did. He is bright. He is aggressive. He is very much a spokesperson for a new generation of Democrats who feel quite comfortable in their liberalism socially and economically. And he's also compiling a pretty successful record as governor of Maryland. Now, that's not exactly what you'd call an automatic springboard to the presidency. The vice presidency is the best springboard. As you say, Joe Biden has some detriments as an inheritor. And, of course, if Barack Obama should lose in November, it's very unlikely that Joe Biden would be seen as the inheritor of a success tradition that would then propel him into the nomination 4 years from now. The person I think most people are focusing on for 2016 is still Hillary Clinton. She would be 69. That would be no older than Ronald Reagan when he was elected in 1980. And Hillary Clinton has moved into a special space in American politics. She has graduated from being a partisan figure, and she is now a post-partisan figure. Republicans are very respectful of the work she has done as Secretary of State. I think Hillary Clinton would be formidable if she has the energy, and Bill Clinton's performance last night suggests to me Bill and Hillary are very much thinking about 2016.
I kind of agree, too, although I suspect that that all the Republican love you're hearing now about Hillary Clinton in 2012 will disappear the moment she indicates she might be a candidate in 2016. Another Democrat we haven't talked about really is Andrew Cuomo. He only made a brief appearance at the convention, no convention speeches, but he's up for re-election in 2014 as governor of New York. He also has a lot of money, a lot of chits, and I thought it was very interesting. A lot of people, Deval Patrick, I think, was one of them too, Cory Booker, Martin O'Malley, they all met with the Iowa delegation at the convention this week, and I wonder what that was all about.
Let's not forget Mark Warner, who right. is a senator from Virginia. He was here. He did get around to a lot of delegations. He did speak to a lot of people and suggest that he is still thinking about how he might run for president. The theme that he hit in those appearances was, I'm not a lifetime politician. I am a person who has built businesses. He actually picked up a little tiny bit of the rhetoric from last week's Republican convention as if to say, I could help us cover that base. I could be a more entrepreneurial figure. Ken, what does Barack Obama need to do on his final night as a politician?
First of all, what we've heard all week long has been nonstop attacks on the Republicans, on the Romney-Ryan ticket. Barack Obama doesn't have to do that. Michelle Obama did it obliquely. Bill Clinton did it very effectively and forcefully. President Obama could just talk about what he has done, what he has tried to accomplish, what he inherited, and what he hoped, you know, and what the differences will be if he's not in office for the next 4 years. We've seen Barack Obama at two presidential conventions so far, the great keynote speech in 2004, the magnificent acceptance speech in 2008. Of course, he was hoping to have a third time this year in an outdoor stadium. Of course, weather has interfered with that. He won't be outdoors before the 70,000 screaming fans. But, You know something? I don't think that the pressure is on him to perform as well as he needed to do because everybody just set him up so perfectly. Ron, I still think we have some unfinished business to talk about regarding the Republican convention. Our podcast last week did not include Mitt Romney's, I thought, very serviceable acceptance speech and the most bizarre moment of the convention, probably the most memorable moment of the convention, the Clint Eastwood chair moment.
Well, I know even some of the people in your own party were very disappointed when you didn't close Gitmo. And I thought, closing Gitmo, why close that? We've spent so much money on it. But I thought maybe it's an excuse. What do you mean, shut up?
unfortunate, really unfortunate, for the people who planned so carefully and scripted so carefully the 3 days that we got of that Republican convention. And they did a marvelous job of editing down a 4-day convention to a 3-day convention. I thought they did most everything right, including the way they handled the Ron Paul rebellion, which was very small. And yet, on the last night, just when you want to have that primetime hour belong to your nominee, Mitt Romney, and introduce him, reintroduce him to the American people as just the guy you see him to be, here comes Clint Eastwood, extraordinary 10, 15 minutes of self-indulgent stand-up humor with the empty chair routine. And it stepped on a little bit the impression that people were hoping to get. And not that Mitt Romney was in any sense involved in that or besmirched by it, but just that people were talking about Clint Eastwood and not about Mitt. That was unfortunate for them.
For the longest time, everybody, all the Republicans, were so nervous about Donald Trump doing something, just something so embarrassing. And once Trump said he's not going to be there, there was a sigh of relief. And how could you fear Clint Eastwood coming to a Republican convention? But years from now, when I'm in my 40s, I will be thinking back to the Republican convention, and I'll be thinking of that Clint Eastwood moment.
You know, years from now, Ken, when you're talking to an empty chair, we'll have a reason to think that's why you're doing it.
That's much different than the usual podcast. Ooh.
Ooh.
I'm so sorry. Anyway, one thing about the presidential race worth noting is that Virgil Goode, the former congressman from Virginia, has made it onto the Virginia ballot as a third-party candidate, the Constitution Party candidate. Now, we don't know how much of a vote he's going to get, but the point is he doesn't have to get that much if the race is very close in Virginia. Obviously, a key swing state. Going back to Florida, we always go back to Florida in 2000, Ralph Nader only got 1.6% of the Florida vote, but that 1.6% was 97,000 votes.
97,000 votes.
Which is only 1.6%, and Al Gore lost by only 537 votes. So in a state that Mitt Romney has got to win if he has a chance to win the presidency, Virginia is one of them, and whatever Virgil Goode picks up will certainly come from the total of Mitt Romney could hurt.
And in the general category of potential third party or independent candidate mischief, this past week we have heard Ron Paul, the man who did not really get what he wanted from Tampa and from the Republican Party, not talking about running himself, of course, too late for that, but talking up the appeal of the candidate of the Libertarian Party, former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson. Anything that Ron Paul says about Gary Johnson on the positive side is probably going to double Gary Johnson's otherwise natural appeal to libertarian voters and libertarian-minded voters who might otherwise vote Republican.
So after tonight, both conventions are over. You've been in Tampa. You're in Charlotte. Any of your last reflections?
The nature of this campaign is so close. The number of undecided voters is so small that we may see two conventions go by and make very little difference at all to the standing of the candidates or the standing of the parties. There's a real question to be asked about whether or not we still need to have these conventions at all, whether or not the platforms are still a reasonable statement of where the parties stand, or whether they're just something to be picked apart by the media. Real questions have to be asked about our whole process of nominating presidents. But for the people who attend them, the people who get caught up in them, they are energizing, they are fun, they remind people why they were interested in politics in the first place. And as far as I'm concerned, I know I got interested in politics because of you, Ken.
Well, Ron, safe trip back, and I guess the next big stuff we'll talk about will be the upcoming debates.
And we'll start in on that next week. That's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
And in Charlotte, North Carolina, I'm Ron Elving.
Hush, hush, sweet Charlotte. I'm Ked Rudin in Washington.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Together again. My tears have stopped falling. The long, lonely nights are now at an end. The key to my heart you hold. Together again. do